Well, our break started 5 minutes late, and this hour is starting 5 minutes late, so we're right on track. Let's come back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel 7, 11b depends on a pun. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. David has been wanting to build a house for God, namely a temple. God says he'll build a house for David, namely a dynasty. There's the pun. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands, and so on and so on and so on. Now then, there are two or three things that need unpacking here. When God promises, I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever, I will be his father, and he will be my son, to whom is he referring? And before you all say Jesus, read the next line. When he does what is wrong, I will punish him with the punishments of men, temporal judgments. In the first instance, at least, there is absolutely no way that can be talking about Jesus. It's talking about Solomon. And you can understand why. Because after all, the only preceding monarch of the unified monarchy was Saul, who started so well, but ended so badly. So David can't help but think, okay, now I'm on the throne. Even if I don't make a mess of things, how can I guarantee what my son will do? Or my son's son? Or my son's son's son? If this is a holy God who will not countenance that kind of deep-seated rebellion, but will destroy the dynasty, then what hope is there for me and my family and my heirs and successors? He can't help but think that. The only model he's got is Saul. And the fact that that's what he's thinking about is made clear by God's gracious response in the next verse, 15. But my love will never be taken away from him, that is your successor, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. In other words, God's grace will so extend to the Davidic line that even where there is horrible sin, God's going to preserve the line. But that's going to be a function of grace, not a function of spectacular obedience. Ask David himself before the end of his life. Now, there's a second thing that needs to be said. I will be his father and he will be my son, verse 14. Where is this coming from? Now, here is where it would have been good to follow sonship themes all the way through the Bible. Before we looked at this one, but I warned you, these themes keep interweaving with one another. You read chapter 6 and 7 together, you've got the temple in here, in both chapter 6 and 7. You've got Jerusalem in here. You've got the Davidic kingship in here. You've got sonship in here. Did you see? They're all coming together. And there's a sense in which you need to have more about sonship before you understand more about kingship and vice versa. But let me have a small excursus here to introduce a bit about sonship, even though I can't say too much. It would take too long. I did write a little book on the subject called Jesus, the Son of God, as I said, and you'll find a lot more of it worked out there. Part of the problem as we think about these things is that the resonances with son in ancient Hebrew culture are different from resonances in our ears about son. Today, you watch one of the CSI-type programs, you know, then every third or fourth program is trying to establish paternity by the use of DNA to the chance of one percentage point in parts per billion or something of that order. So sonship is established by genetics. But sonship, by and large, in our culture, does not establish continuity of identity through vocation. Let's try a small experiment. I've done it in many, many parts of the world. But let's try it. Just for the men, first of all. We'll come to the women in a moment. Just for the men. How many of you men are doing vocationally now what your fathers did at the same age? Let me see your hands. Four or five hands out of 400. You women, how many of you are doing vocationally at your age what your mothers did at the same time? Let me see your hands. Three, I think. Do you see what I mean? In the ancient world, if your father was a farmer, the chances were overwhelming that you become a farmer. And this, not only in ancient Israel, but in the Greco-Roman world, all the way down to the time of the Industrial Revolution. It took the Industrial Revolution to change this. Social structures were bound up with family vocation. If your father was a farmer, you became a farmer. Your father was a baker, you became a baker. Your father was a sea captain, you went to sea. Your father's name was Stradivarius, you built violins. You know, that's the way it works. And therefore, you read older novels of this period, and it's a major, major event when a son in particular decides he doesn't want to take over the family business and goes and does something else. Well, nowadays, you don't have a crisis over that, except in the most amazingly conservative of families. Did you see? Because there's no expectation that it should be so. That's why in the Gospels, Jesus is not only identified pretty commonly as the son of the carpenter, that's the way he's perceived, but in one passage in Mark as the carpenter himself. Apparently what's happened is Joseph has died and he's taken over the family business until he begins his public ministry. He's the carpenter. That identifies him. He's not Mr. Smith. He's the carpenter. And moreover, the identification by vocation is rich for another reason. There weren't vocational schools. If you wanted to be a farmer in the ancient world, your father was a farmer and you wanted to be a farmer, you don't go off to agricultural college for 4 years and then come home. Your father teaches you when to sow, how to plow, how to build fences, how to reap, how to read the weather, and so on. Your education is coming from your father. You're the farmer's son. Mr. Stradivarius Jr. doesn't go off to violin school somewhere, you know, really nice course in advanced carpentry. Rather, he learns his trade from his father. That reality accounts for a lot of sonship metaphors in the Bible. So, Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God." A lot of our translations have children of God, but it really is sons of God, since it's working on this sonship theme. It applies to men and women. What does that mean? Does that mean this is how you become a Christian? No, 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 no.